People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions.
Hello from me, Chris Nicklin, with this week's People of Note. Our guest is Francie Joel, whose mother was Helen Suzman, the one-person battering ram against the apartheid regime for so many years. Francie's an eminent art historian, having trained at London's Courtauld Institute and receiving a PhD from Harvard University. But it's about her famous mother we'll be chatting today. Francie's out from London for the centenary celebrations of Helen Suzman's birth on November the 7th, coinciding as it does, Francie, with the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. I remember meeting Helen for the first time after seeing so many newspaper photos and being struck how slight she was, yet she had this very determined demeanour and a voice that put you in your place immediately.
Yes, indeed she did. She was tiny. People often marked on that. I think Mandela, when he first saw her, comments on her, this tiny woman walking through the jail, completely unfazed.
I interviewed your mother on numerous occasions, and she had no hesitation telling journalists they were speaking rubbish or that they'd got their facts wrong. Was she always so direct?
She was always so direct, and she was always correct on her facts, and she was always quite intolerant of people who weren't.
In fact, I vividly remember her standing up to the BBC's bulldog presenter, Jeremy Paxman, at the time of the 1994 elections. I'd been living in the UK for some years and hadn't seen Paxman getting his comeuppance quite like that.
Yes, he gave a rather sort of embarrassed little smile, which I'd never, ever seen him do. She corrected him on, I think it was something to do with Winnie Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to know about her relationship. He was critical of her, and she said, well, how would you like to have been in solitary confinement? And how would you like to have been 7 years exiled or banished to a remote town? She attacked him.
And of course, she would know everything about Winnie Mandela because she was a close at the time.
She first visited Winnie Mandela in Brandfort in 1977. She drove there by herself. And she went two or three times to see her, usually having encounters with the police and arguments with the police. And then when Winnie Mandela came back to Soweto in the late 80s, 1986, I think it was, she went visiting schools with her. And there's a very nice photograph of them together.
Mm. Tell me something about Helen's parents. I know, very sadly, her mother died just 2 weeks after her birth.
Her parents were both immigrants from Lithuania, came out at the turn of the century, quite penniless. The father came somewhere around 1900, 1901, and he had an older child, and then his wife died when, her name was Frieda, died when Helen was born. They moved in with his brother, who was married to a sister of his late wife, and they lived like that for about 10 years, very modestly, and he built up a business. He remarried when she was about 10, and at that point they moved to Parktown.
Mm. Apparently her father never spoke about her mother. And Helen first saw a photo of her mother when she was 55. That's quite extraordinary. Why do you think that was so?
There was no, apparently people didn't talk. It was almost too painful, but she never saw, she didn't even know where the mother came from or when she came. And that was first discovered by researchers, Millie Pimstone, when she organized the 2005 exhibition about my mother, called Helen Suzman, Fighter for Human Rights, at the museum, Jewish Museum in Cape Town. And then they found exactly when she had come out, had stayed in London with her family. She was aged about 18 then, at a place called the Poor Jews Temporary Shelter, and came out on a ship in 1901, went to Kimberley. But that was the first any kind of official or documentary evidence she had about her mother. It was quite moving.
Do you know why her father may have withheld it from her then?
I think it was a way in which people dealt with grief. There were no photographs. She only saw it when she was sorting through the belongings belonging to her aunt, who was the mother's, her mother's sister, that she found this extraordinary photograph.
Hmm. Francie, let's hear your first choice of music, please. What is it?
Right. Well, I should just preface by saying that our house was always filled with music, classical and jazz and popular, which my father adored all music. My mother did not particularly like classical music, but she loved musicals, jazz, popular music. Early in 1953, she met, or we all met, Danny Kaye when he came out to South Africa.
This was before the cultural boycott.
Long before the cultural boycott. Yeah, 53, 54, I'm not sure which year. They became great friends, indeed family friends. So my first choice is When the Saints Go Marching In, which was originally a gospel hymn, but which was jazzed up by Danny Kaye and Louis Armstrong in the late 50s in a film called The Five Pennies. And I know she would have loved this.
Let's take a listen then.
Billy, you want to give me a key or something? Put me to work.
When the saints
go marching in,
go marching in.
When the saints go marching in,
ooh, yeah.
I want to be in that number. When the saints go marching in.
When the saints go marching in, who's gonna play on the day when the saints go marching in?
Well, Louis, I'll explain that now. The mostest and the greatest,
from the oldest to the latest,
gonna play in the band in the great grandstand when the saints go marching in. Louis, what about Brahms?
He laid no bomb.
And Chopin?
Solid man. And Bach, that great old master.
Yeah, that great old master was a gasser.
Yes, but Mozart the most with all he had.
With the symphonies and operas and all that jazz.
Do you dig Rachmaninoff?
On and off.
Rimsky?
Of course. Ravel and Gustav Mahler.
Yeah, but don't forget Fats Waller.
I wouldn't do that. List that's a twist that you can't resist.
Yeah, put list on that list.
When the saints go marching in.
Here we go, man. When the saints go marching in. This cat digging, man.
When the saints go marching in.
Face and all.
I want to be in that number. Sad song,
C-Bomb.
And George Bizet.
Très Bizet.
Butant, Souffé, Machinet.
And often Bach.
Do you dig him, Jacques?
Very often.
Well, Frère Jacques. I dig you, Jacques. Massenet and Bizet. How about Wagner?
Devout.
And Haydn.
Who?
Joseph Haydn.
Who?
Haydn.
We'll let him come out.
Paganini.
Rossini.
Toscanini.
Puccini.
Hachaturian.
Gozontai.
Thank you. And what's his name?
Mr. Beatlesau.
And you know that cat.
Yes, Beatlesau.
That was Danny Kaye and Louis Armstrong with When the Saints Go Marching In. The choice of our guest on People of Notes this week, Francie Joel. Francie, why did Helen get involved in politics in the first place? Because let's face it, when she joined the opposition party in the 1950s and became MP for Houghton, women were scarce in the political arena, and that's the way it was then.
She became interested in politics or involved in politics in the late 40s when she worked for the Institute of Race Relations and researched on the Fagan Commission, which was a commission which was to investigate the conditions of blacks in the urban areas after the war.
Because she'd been trained at Wits as an economic historian, hadn't she?
She was teaching, indeed, as an economic historian, and very soon learnt about the dreadful migratory labor system, which she thought was absolutely iniquitous. And she found when she did her research that the townships outside Johannesburg, she realized how appalling the conditions were for people and how much they suffered under this.
And the huge influx of black people into cities at the time was a direct consequence of the Second World War, wasn't it?
Exactly, because the influx controls were cancelled during the war because of the need for labor, apparently. Mm. And so new policies were being sought. However, then the nationalists came in. Yeah.
Yeah, and they wanted to push back the tide, so to speak, of black people coming into the cities.
Yes, and to control and just keep a reinstate a migratory labor system. Then in 1948, when the nationalists won the election, she was so appalled, and she got more and more involved in politics, started speaking at different meetings, and then somebody quite casually said, why didn't she stand in 1953? I don't think she wasn't a career politician, so she didn't intend to be in politics all her life. It was almost accidental, and I think she thought she probably wouldn't win it, or she would hand it over to somebody else, but that's not how it worked.
She became an MP for Houghton, as I say, but became quickly disillusioned with the United Party. What was the problem for her?
The problem was that they were not opposing. They were quite equivocal about opposing the nationalist policy of apartheid. And she and a small group of colleagues got more and more impatient. There were several times when they almost left the party. The final straw was in 1959. And that's when they formed the Progressive Party.
We'll get on to that in a moment, Francie, but I think it's important to point out that while rejecting racial discrimination, Helen was still in favor of a qualified franchise, as were the other MPs considering breaking away from the United Party. They believed that blacks should have certain educational and economic qualifications to be included on the voters.
Yes, not only blacks, everyone. I think the qualified franchise was supposed to, and of course they were thinking of, I suppose, voters and how people, but by the mid-70s, of course, that was abandoned for universal franchise. And I think she would have done it earlier, but there were constraints from other people.
So when your mother and several fellow MPs finally decided to break away and form the Progressive Party, I believe the meeting took place at your home, and
yes,
you were in on it.
I remember it. Well, I remember sitting on the floor behind the couch listening to all their deliberations, and it was very exciting. And they were consulting a lot of African leaders as well at the time. I left a few months later because I had finished at Wits and I went across to England to study. So after that, although we kept very closely in touch because my mother wrote to me almost every week, and I have a wonderful record of her for the next 30 years, of her activities, her time in Parliament, her feelings about things. And she had one year, the next year, of course, was Sharpeville and the emergency. And that's when things got really hot. And of course, they opposed the emergency regulations. And that's when she started visiting prisons and refusing to be intimidated. And she wrote to me in 1960 about how I refuse to be intimidated. As long as I have my parliamentary privilege, I will use it to the last day. And indeed, she stood up in Parliament, started intervening for politicals who were clapped in 1960 during the emergency.
Your parents got married when your mother was very young. She was only 19 at the time. Your father, Mosey, was a well-known but apparently quite private Johannesburg physician. What did he make of her increasingly controversial political career?
She always encouraged it. Mm-hmm. He always encouraged it.
Oh, so he wasn't taking shelter in the study while she was...
No, he was very involved in his work. They both were deeply involved in their professional lives, and he certainly encouraged her.
Oh, so he was actually egging her on?
Yes, well, when he heard that she was being asked to stand, and he heard her saying, oh, I can't possibly leave the house, he said, go on, it's what you've been working for the last few years. And so she did.
Right, Francie, let's have a listen to your second choice of music.
Right, my second choice is from the South African jazz opera King Kong, which has recently been revived in Cape Town and
yes.
I think plays in Johannesburg as well. And the reason for this was in 1959 that it first came on. I've chosen In the Queue, which is a particularly beautiful song in the jazz opera. It was written by Todd Machikiza, who was a close friend of mine, and one of the reasons I chose this is it's the one song in the show that deviates slightly from the narrative, the main narrative, and very subtly underlines political situation, the poverty and the hardship of people standing in line waiting to go to work, those early morning queues. And the words just will keep moving. It's cold, the rain chills our bones. They talk about hunger, poverty, being attacked by Tsotsis. Anyhow, it's a very moving and beautiful song. What is also interesting for me is it's reminiscent of a piece that Todd and I listened to at our house once, which was a Chopin nocturne, the center part of a Chopin nocturne in G minor. But of course, he transformed it into something quite different and I think beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Right, let's hear it.
Magdoda,
That was In the Queue from the South African jazz opera King Kong, Francie Joel's choice in this week's People of Note. Francie, as your mother threw herself into an even more adversarial political role in South Africa, you mentioned you were preparing or had left the country for London. Was it your plan to leave for good?
I don't think I knew at the time. It turned out that way. But I was in the middle of my course at the Courtauld when the 61 election was called.
Because you came back to help her and contest the Houghton seat, didn't you?
Yes, I skipped a term at the Courtauld and I came back and worked with her and to help with the election. And then slightly to our horror, she was the only person returned, which was a bit worrying.
What was it like being part of that breakthrough moment for her, though?
Well, it was very exciting initially until on cold dawn you realized what that meant, that she was going back totally alone.
Yes, and that indeed started a long parliamentary career for her, where she was the only Prog MP in Parliament for, I think, what was it, about
13 years.
Yes. In a sense, she was in a kind of political wilderness. How daunting was that for her?
It was very lonely, and it was a huge amount of work. I mean, her letters, which she wrote to me sometimes from Parliament on those old blue aerograms, all by hand, would describe the sheer grind of work. How this week, she says, I have to talk about 5 different bills. And the constant harassment. She had to sit in the House sometimes till 10:30 at night, day after day, because she didn't want to miss anything or miss an opportunity to object. There was one, I think it was the sabotage bill, she moved 17 amendments. Of course, none of them were taken, but as she put it, at least people knew that not everybody accepted this dreadful, you know, the dreadful bill, the dreadful legislation.
But it might have been daunting for her to be the only Prog MP, but not daunting enough, clearly, to pick apart and attack every bit of racially discriminatory legislation that was being enacted by the Nats as they pursued their dream of grand apartheid.
Yeah, she didn't let anything go through. She objected at every point. She was there day and night. Very conscientious, did amazing research, spoke very well, had a lot of time. She was given by the Speaker, Klopper, who recognized her constantly through the House. So he really helped her in a way, although he was a diehard nationalist. But he said she had to have her opportunity to give her point of view.
Where did she get the energy and resources to invest all this time in picking apart the legislation?
She was just very conscientious and energetic and determined to do it. She had only 2 helpers. She had a secretary and a researcher who helped with the questions. She put endless questions in Parliament, and she used Parliament to shame the government, to expose atrocities. expose conditions that couldn't otherwise be published in the press. She even in 1963 read out Mandela's speech, his defense, in his 1962 trial. At the time, that would have been completely forbidden. But because she read it out in Parliament, it could be published in the newspapers. So she played a really important role of making things known, of informing South Africans generally, the whole, and also the rest of the world about what was going on.
Yes. Your mother even, I believe, won some grudging admiration from the National Party mouthpiece at the time, De Burger, which described her as putting up a parliamentary performance which is impressing even her enemies.
I think that's true. I think they became more respectful, but in the early days, the insults were really extraordinary. I mean, they were anti-Semitic, they were chauvinist, they were patronized. She was accused of being an agitator, a communist, treacherous for the country, she should leave the country, and so on.
So how did she deal with these nasty personal attacks? Because they were really sustained over many years.
They were sustained, and she gave as good as she got. She was very witty. She didn't really care about that because she didn't respect them. In fact, she had utter contempt both for them and for the main opposition party. I mean, there's that wonderful phrase, I think it's with the 90 days, when she was the only one to oppose that legislation. And she divided the whole house. She was left one person on the green benches and the rest of the house, the rest of the parties all on the other side. And she made that comment about she's noticed a shiver running around the United Party looking for a spine to go up.
But she was famed for her biting repartee, wasn't she? Can you think of any other good examples?
Well, I've been reading the Hansards recently because I've been reading all her letters and comparing them to the Hansards to see her words private and public. And the Hansards are extraordinary. I mean, there's one where she's criticized and she says, I don't care what you think of me. I only care about the opinions of people I respect. And then she goes on with her speech. Or somebody was complaining about her views of the rest of the world. And she says something about, as far as I know, the member for Rustenburg has never been out of Rustenburg. But of course, he knows about the world. And then continues.
She was in Parliament when Hendrik Verwoerd was assassinated, and P.W. Burton marched up and accused her of actual responsibility, didn't
he? Yes, he did. He said, you liberalists, you communists, we're going to get you now. She was absolutely furious. And he did it very grudgingly. He was called to the speaker. They both went, and where he had to apologize, which he did, as I say, very grudgingly. She couldn't bear Sputa. She found him a bully, irascible, irrational, and dangerous.
Despite the attacks on her, she interestingly observed, though, that she wasn't blameless because she could be quite provocative herself.
Yes, she could be. Indeed, she could be.
Francie, let's take a listen to your third choice of music, please.
The third choice of music is something quite zany, just the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. I don't know why she liked it. Doesn't have any particular association, excepting she really did, and she always enjoyed it.
Probably appealed to her slightly zany sense
of
humour.
Yes, I think it did. Towards the end of her life, when we chatted about her memorial service, what we would do about it, she actually said that's what she wanted to be played. In the end, of course, we didn't. We had the Witz Choir who sang, and it wasn't part of their repertoire.
In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed submarine.
That was the Beatles' famous Yellow Submarine, the choice of Francie Joll on this week's People of Note, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. Francie, after Helen's solo act in Parliament for 13 years, the breakthrough came in 1974 when the Progs won a further 5 seats, Colin Eglin and Frederick Van Zyl slubbered among them. It must have been a big turning point for her.
It was indeed, and she used to talk about how she could get rid of some of the portfolios she had to look after, like a snake gets rid of its skin, she thought that was. But she still had a lot of work. She dealt with justice and prisons, which was really one of her abiding concerns, that right through the 80s.
Her focus was very much on human rights, wasn't she?
Human rights, and also she continued right till the end of her career of always going out, as she put it, to see for herself. So that she visited the sort of desolate places where people had been forcibly removed.
I was going to say, one of her guiding rules as a parliamentarian, and one of the principal reasons, I suppose, for her effectiveness, was always to go out and see for herself what she was intervening
yes,
about.
Yes, absolutely. And she was absolutely fearless. I mean, people would phone at all times, day and night, often asking for help if there was some sort of unrest or some problem. She would just go off by herself, unescorted, to see if she could intervene and help, whether it was the police beating up people or other times going to see people who were being threatened with removal, the group areas removals. She went to rural areas, she went into the cities, she always checking, and of course prisons was the area she was very concerned with.
Did she take her personal safety into account, because she was in some rather risky situations?
She never did. There was only one time, she told me, that she felt she was in danger. It was once when she was driving back on a long straight road from Brandfort after seeing Winnie Mandela, and she noticed a car following her. And the thought crossed her mind that how easy it would be to run her off the road. But otherwise, she was amazingly courageous. Well, she wasn't, as you always said, she wasn't frightened, so it wasn't courage.
Let's talk about her visits to prisons, and famously, she developed a relationship with Nelson Mandela. She very often went into prisons as the only white MP who'd ever visited these places of incarceration.
She started with the emergency in the 60s, and then in the mid-60s, after there was the Rivonia trial and after the students were imprisoned, Hugh Lewin and people like
this,
that.
Was that the 76 uprising?
No, that was earlier, 60s, mid-60s. Yes. She started going into prisons and apparently helped improve the conditions to do with study, to do with access, to do with even food and clothes. And she visited in 1967. She wrote to me to say that she'd had permission to visit Hugh Lewin in jail, and she was given permission to supply the politicals with a record player and records. And quite a business, she said, as I also have to provide loudspeakers for all their cells. But no matter, having music at night will be a godsend to them. She got a list from them and then subsequently sent the records.
Mm. Let's talk about her visits to Robben Island. I interviewed various Rivonia trialists over the years and other Robben Island prisoners, and they all comment about how important her visits were, that in fact whenever the food improved dramatically, they knew that Helen Suzman was coming to visit.
She first went in 1967 after there'd been reports of appalling conditions. That is when she first met Nelson Mandela. He had been moved to another cell from his usual cell at the end of a passage, apparently in the hope that she would be talking to the other prisoners and wouldn't have time to speak to him. But the other said, please go straight ahead and speak to our leader, Mandela. And that's where he gave her a list of complaints, including one about a particularly brutal warder who had a swastika on his hand. And indeed, she had him removed by threatening to expose this. I think conditions did change. And one of the prisoners subsequently wrote, who knows what would have happened if she hadn't come. Mm.
What did she write to you about Nelson Mandela in those snail mail letters she used to send you?
She only had permission to see him about 4 times in prison. She asked every year. And she saw him and Sobukwe and all the others. And she just wrote about how distinguished he was, how amazingly confident he was, and how he was the one hope for the country.
These were very important visits for the outside world, because we had Helen Suzman describing how Mandela actually was, who he was, and what he believed in.
Yes. Yes, she was. She was very impressed with him, and they became fast friends, and even, of course, after he was released, their friendship continued right to the end of their lives. He took her with him. I think there's the signing of the Constitution at Sharpeville in 96, he apparently called her up and said, Helen, what are you doing next Friday? And she said, why, what should I be doing? He said, well, I'll come and collect you. And off they went to some rugby field where they got into a helicopter and went to Sharpeville. So she was there and she saw the old prison, the people who'd been imprisoned, who all greeted her apparently with open arms.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about Winnie Mandela and the relationship that your mother developed with her while she was under banishment in Brandfort. That was quite a difficult relationship because, A, it was a long-distance relationship, but Winnie Mandela had really become the ogre of the white communities, so she must have had to put up with a lot to actually undertake these visits to Brandfort.
Well, the earlier, I think, visits in Brandfort, she wasn't quite an ogre. She was, you know, she was being terribly badly persecuted and isolated.
Later, I mean an ogre in the way she was being projected to the white
community. Yes, but Helen always defended her, saying she had been suffered so much in her life. She worried sometimes about Winnie's behavior later, but...
But in some respects, she was very much a lifeline for Winnie Mandela while she was under that ban.
Yes, she was. And also, Winnie Mandela used to contact her when she had reports that Nelson needed visit and needed help, and she would immediately try and do this, yes.
Righto, Franzi, let's listen to your fourth choice of music.
Beethoven's Ode to Joy from the Ninth Symphony. And the reason for this is that when Helen took records, and a record player and had loudspeakers installed at Pretoria Central for the prisoners there, politicals, Hugh described the records that she brought, and he wrote about in his wonderful book, Bandit. It included Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart, Richter recital, and Oistrakh recital, and he specifies Beethoven's Ninth. So I thought that would be an appropriate thing to choose, especially since the Ode to Joy is sometimes seen as an ode to freedom, and I'm sure they listened to it. It must have resounded through their cells.
Well, here it is. Deine Zauberwinde wieder, was die Liebe strengen ein. Alle Menschen werden Brüder, wo dein sanfter Flügel ein. Thank you. That was Beethoven's Ode to Joy from the Ninth Symphony, the choice of our guest on People of Note today, Francie Joel. Francie, in some respects, the progressives never became the political force your mother wished for in the mid-1980s, just as the Nats were at their reactionary worst. The then leader of the party, Fonsale Slabbert, stunned supporters by suddenly abandoning ship, saying extra-party politics had become more meaningful in the country. How much of a setback was this for Helen?
It was a disappointment, and she was quite stunned, and she felt very let down. And for a while, she was very angry with him. She felt that there was still work to be done in the parliament, because it was the government. It was persuading the Nats, it was fighting the Nats, and now, of course, the far-right Conservative Party.
But for many other people, it was the right thing to do, because they believed that the presence of respected MPs like your mother in the South African parliament gave credence to a woefully discredited organization.
Yes, but I don't think you would find people, prisoners for whom she'd intervened, saying things like that. And she used Parliament to expose things, to undermine the government. And that, I think, still remained a very important aspect of her work. I mean, the late 80s, there were terrible things happening in prison. She read out in Parliament some of the accounts of torture and of mistreatment in the prisons, which wouldn't otherwise have been publicly known about. So she still felt there was work to be done in Parliament. But she became friends again. I mean, they made up, yeah. and their friendship continued, because they were basically on the same side.
She maintained she was able to use her parliamentary privilege to continue to expose abuses in prisons.
Absolutely. Not only that, and the last thing she did in Parliament, her last session, was to have a judge impeached, or to attack a judge who'd given an unfair judgment on a farmer who had apparently beaten a worker to death. So she was right up to the end. She was challenging people and challenging the government. And she was challenging it in its own, if you like, its own citadel, in its own parliament, mm-hmm. its own legislature.
The other hotly contested issue at the time was the question of general sanctions to force the Nats to ditch apartheid. But your mother was resolutely against disinvestment. It made a lot of enemies among people who might have counted as her admirers. But yes. So why was she so adamant?
Well, I know at the beginning when disinvest, she always disapproved of the cultural, and she didn't disapprove of all sanctions. She was perfectly in agreement with the sports boycott, because she thought that would force multiracial sport in this country. I don't think she opposed the military and oil sanctions. Disinvestment was another thing, because there she was a very practical person. She wasn't interested in gestures or having people, you know, people feeling good because they weren't eating South African bananas or what. She was very practical, and she thought of disinvestment would simply deprive people of jobs, industries would pull out, and it would just cause more poverty. She felt that the African population would have more muscle, more political muscle or industrial muscle through trade unions and empowerment through jobs, and that this would undermine that.
Was she never willing to acknowledge the counter-argument by the people who were pro-sanctions, that black people were hurting so much already, economic sanctions was a weapon in their arsenal to overturn apartheid?
She did acknowledge it, but she said, you ask somebody whether they are prepared to lose their job for economic sanctions, and the answer is inevitably no. I mean, unemployment to her was one of the scourges, the poverty, and because this was a country that had no social security, that had no safety net for people, and she always was struggling against poverty. She was adamant about that. But she saw their point. She used to go onto American campuses where the students were all wanting disinvestment, and she would say, I understand why you feel better if you do that, but actually the results aren't necessarily what you think they'll be. And she thought that if capital was taken out of the country, industries sold at prices, they would also lose the protection of the social programs that some of the foreign firms had here.
Mm-hmm. Righto, Francie, your fifth and final musical choice. What is it, please?
Well, my final choice is actually relates to the question you've just asked, because it dates from 1978, when she was in America, and she wrote to me about how indeed she was having to counter people's disapproval because of her stance on sanctions. But she said she wasn't prepared to make any concessions. She didn't adjust what she said according to her audiences. But one very enjoyable evening she spent in New York was going to a musical called Ain't Misbehavin', which was about Fats Waller. It was a musical review about Fats Waller. And she wrote to me and said, I did see Ain't Misbehavin'. It was delicious. It was wonderful. And so my last choice is Fats Waller singing Ain't Misbehavin'.
Fats Waller's Ain't Misbehavin', the final choice of music in People of Note today from our guest, Francie Joel. Francie, Helen viewed our country's new constitution as a triumph of liberalism in South Africa because it enshrined so many liberal values, many of the things she fought for. But as you know, the role of liberals in our political life has come in for much criticism, typically portraying them as middle-class whites who wring their hands about inequality while clinging to their comfortable lives. How did Helen deal with this critique, which, let's face it, is perfectly true in some respects?
Well, she could only talk from her own point of view, and she just thought these were values that were worth fighting for. I stand for simple justice, equal opportunity, and human rights. As she put it, these are indispensable elements in a democratic society and well worth fighting for, and she did fight for them. She fought for the rule of law, the universal franchise, for free elections, free association, guaranteed civil rights, and, most important, an independent judiciary.
How do you think she would have tackled the ills in South African society today with rank corruption from President Zuma down?
I'm hesitant to say what she would say, but I'm sure she would be outraged at that. But she would also be outraged at the poverty and the unemployment. On the other hand, she would probably be pleased that the Constitutional Court is still upholding the Constitution and that civil society is alive and that there's a lot of opposition and that there is a lot of opposition in the press and from various individuals, brave, courageous individuals.
Well, Francie Joel, all that's left is to wish your mother a happy 100th birthday on the 9th of November. Thank you for joining us on People of Note.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Need a good laugh? Want to stop stressing about everything that could go wrong? Then get to Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay to catch the return season of the London West End hit comedy, The Play That Goes Wrong. The side-splitting, hysterical, award-winning farce is directed by me, Alan Committee. After weeks of rave reviews, standing ovations and raucous laughter in Joburg, this show comes to Cape Town until the 18th of November. The Play That Goes Wrong at Theatre on the Bay. Book now. A play so perfectly wrong, it's hysterically right.